May 1st, 1994. The day of the San Marino Grand Prix. Normally, this would be just another race day. But not that weekend. Formula One was reaching the end of its darkest race weekend in its entire history. Yet tragically, no one had any idea just how dark things were about to get. No one knew that the sport was about to change forever. Formula One is dangerous. That's the way it's always been, and that's the way it will always be. No matter what safety procedures are introduced, when you're driving a racing car at 200 miles per hour, anything can happen, even to the very best of drivers. And this was about to be proven. And tragically, this was proven through the very best driver in the world being taken from us. 2019 marks 25 years since the events of the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix, and the impact of what took place that weekend is still felt a quarter of a century later. Despite how awful this race weekend was, the story of those 3 days should be told. If it weren't, it would be disrespectful to the 2 men we lost that weekend. This episode is both a remembrance of what took place, but also a tribute to who we lost, and a celebration of what they both achieved. I'm Rob Manifold, and welcome to F1 Everything, episode 13, Imola 1994. Before we tackle the San Marino Grand Prix weekend itself, I want to give a quick recap of the 94 season so far. I covered this quite extensively in episode 11 of the podcast, but I feel it's important to explain it again just to demonstrate how much pressure Ayrton Senna was under heading into that fateful weekend. In fact, this episode picks up from where episode 12 finished, at the end of 1993. At the end of 93, Senna finally got the move he wanted. He left McLaren and joined the dominant Williams team. In 1992 and in 1993, Williams were considerably faster than everyone else, and both Nigel Mansell and Alain Prost respectively had wrapped up their drivers' titles with relative ease. Naturally, Senna wanted some of that and jumped ship. His teammate was Damon Hill, who had done a great job in his first full season in 93, taking 3 wins and at times being the best driver on track. But it was very clear heading into 1994 that Senna was going to be the number one driver at Williams. I mean, how could he not be? He was the best driver on the grid. And with Williams' track record, you'd think things were about to go swimmingly for the team from the off. What they hadn't anticipated was how much of a step Benetton were about to take, specifically Michael Schumacher. The Benetton B194 was a great car, albeit a controversial one, but I'll get to that shortly. At the opening race of the 94 season in Brazil, Senna took pole from Schumacher in second, and the two sped away from the front and built up a ridiculous lead. The gap between the two remained at only a few seconds throughout the opening period of the race. However, things changed after they both pitted. Senna had a slow stop. Schumacher had a much quicker one and was out ahead of the Brazilian. Under pressure to catch the young German, Senna spun his Williams, stalled it, and was out of his home race. Schumacher would go on to win by a full lap over everyone else. The Benetton team made a huge statement with that victory, though questions began to be asked about the legality of its car. One of the reasons why Williams had been so dominant the previous 2 seasons was down to their use of electronic aids, such as active suspension and traction control. In 1994, those things had been banned to close things up, and Williams really felt this. All that technology that they had pioneered and utilised so brilliantly were no longer legal. These new rulings were obviously applied to everyone else as well. Well, you'd think. At the second race of the 94 season at Aida in Japan, the Pacific Grand Prix. A twisty yet underrated little circuit in my opinion. Senna took pole again from Schumacher in second, but the Brazilian was involved in an opening lap incident, which saw his race end after just one corner. Schumacher would lead the race from there, and the Brazilian began investigating Schumacher's car. He stood by the side of the course, by the first corner, and watched and listened to the Benetton, and became convinced that it wasn't legal. The way the car sounded and behaved, especially coming out of the corners, was familiar to that of a car relying on traction control. While Senna's Williams, for example, was unpredictable and difficult to drive, which was the whole point of the new regulations, the B194 looked quite simple and easy to drive. Senna wanted his Williams team to appeal. They chose not to. After the opening two rounds, Schumacher had the full 20 points on offer. Senna had 0 points. The Brazilian needed a good race weekend next time out at Imola. What would end up occurring is just unthinkable. Imola was considered one of the most challenging, ballsy circuits in motor racing. It wasn't especially wide, it was quite bumpy, and it had a mixture of low and super high speed sections which made it a tricky circuit to set your car up for. The lap would start with a 200 mile per hour blast through Tamburello and the Villeneuve curve before a low speed hairpin at Tozza. The rest of the lap is a mixture of medium speed corners and tight twisty chicanes before that terrifying blast back down to Tozza. The circuit had seen some serious accidents over the years before 1994. Most famously, Gerhard Berger had a near fatal fiery crash at Tamburello, which I'm sure I will cover in more detail in a future Gerhard Berger episode of the podcast. But it shows that Imola was a circuit that could really hurt if things didn't go well. And between April 29th and May 1st, 1994, the world was about to find this out in the worst ways possible. It would all start with Friday. Back during this time, there were two qualifying sessions, one on the Friday afternoon and one on the Saturday afternoon. Whatever was your fastest lap across both sessions would be your overall qualifying time, and that would help decide your starting place. So naturally, everyone was on the limit during the Friday session. Everyone was tackling the Imola circuit. But Imola was about to dish out its first piece of pain that weekend. Rubens Barrichello, a young hotshot from Brazil, was pushing his Jordan. Heading into the San Marino Grand Prix weekend, Rubens had scored 7 points from 20 and was actually lying second in the championship standings, having finished 4 from Brazil and 3rd in Aida in Japan. And whilst expectations for this form to continue weren't high, Rubens was on a run of good fortune. That good fortune would end at the very Antivassa, a quick little chicane near the end of the lap. His car understeered off the track, his tyres locked up, and Rubens was sent airborne thanks to a curb on the side of the track at some 140 miles per hour. At this point, he was completely out of control and was a mere passenger. His Jordan hit the top of the tyre barrier, violently bringing the car to an almost standstill straight away at a rate of 95 Gs, and his car violently nosedived into the ground, resulting in Rubens' head smashing into the steering wheel. The car would roll over twice and come to a stop upside down. It's honestly one of the scariest non-fatal crashes you'll ever see. It's a miracle that the G-force alone didn't kill him, let alone smashing his head into the steering wheel. The initial marshal who arrived on the scene did a ham-handed job of safely bringing his Jordan back down the right way round, merely choosing to push the car back over, and Rubens' head rolled around quite a bit in the cockpit. By this point, Rubens was unconscious. But only around a minute after the crash, Professor Sid Watkins, someone who would play a vital role throughout the weekend, and his team arrived on the scene and trackside treatment began. measures were taken to prevent Rubens from swallowing his own tongue, which would have blocked his airwave and undoubtedly killed him. He was taken to the medical center, and fellow Brazilian Ayrton Senna was the first to visit him. The press frantically gathered around Senna after his visit, and he confirmed that Rubens was okay, albeit shocked, as you would expect. Rubens was taken to hospital for precautionary checkups and observations, but he would actually return to the circuit the next day, albeit to say his goodbyes to the team, as he had been ruled out from competing for the rest of the weekend due to a broken nose. Quite honestly, Rubens was very lucky to survive this accident. And there were a couple of factors that played a vital role in this. One was Professor Sid Watkins. Without him taking the correct measures whilst treating him trackside, Rubens would have died, as I've explained. Secondly, is the fact that Rubens hit the tyre barriers next to the track, not the catch fencing. If Rubens had gone airborne and hit the fence, I dread to think. Not just for him, but for the spectators sat behind it. It doesn't bear thinking about. You only have to look up incidents in IndyCar where cars have gotten airborne and ended up crashing into the catch fencing to know how awful it is. Just ask Robert Wickens, who is still recovering every single day following an airborne catch fence related crash during an IndyCar race at Pocono in 2018. I'm wishing Robert a speedy recovery, by the way. What Rubens' survival did was provide both a blessing and a curse that weekend. Despite how violent Barrichello's crash was, he did survive it. No one had died. No one had died in Formula One for over a decade. People have had horror shunts, like Martin Donnelly at Jerez, and they still survived. Damon Hill has said that we all brushed ourselves off after Rubens' crash and carried on with qualifying, reassured that our cars were as tough as tanks and we could be shaken but not hurt. The drivers just got back in their cars and carried on as normal. I guess when you compete in something as dangerous as Formula One, that is just what you have to do. Otherwise, you would just stop. But an air of invincibility was now present. Drivers now had, in inverted commas, proof that these cars couldn't kill you no matter what you did. Well, at least it seemed that way. Tragically, this feeling of invincibility would last just 24 hours before the San Marino Grand Prix weekend would take its first tragic turn. Roland Ratzenberger was a Formula One rookie. His career had taken him from Formula Ford, British Formula 3, British Formula 3000, and even the British and World Touring Car Championships respectively in the 80s, as well as various Le Mans and Japanese Formula 3000. But he'd finally gotten his big break in 94 with Simtek. He'd signed a 5-year contract with the team and was looking to make a good impression. He had failed to qualify for the season opener in Brazil, but due to the fact that he was the only person on the grid to have previously driven the circuit at Aida, he finished 11th at the Pacific Grand Prix, the race before Imola. And people were beginning to take notice of the 33-year-old Austrian. He was quick by his very nature, and therefore was thriving at the ultra-fast Imola circuit. And he was hotly in pursuit of his second Formula One qualification. However, Roland Ratzenberger's life was about to be tragically taken before the world's eyes. The lap before his accident, he'd damaged his front wing. Instead of pitting for repairs, Roland chose to continue. As he began another lap, he rounded Tamburello and approached the flat-out Villeneuve curve. But his front wing failed due to the damage and the sheer amount of downforce the car was producing because of the speed. From that moment, Roland was a complete passenger. His Simtek failed to turn, and at close to 200 miles per hour, Roland Ratzenberger slammed into a concrete wall. The video footage of the crash is legitimately hard to watch. And whilst I would gingerly recommend you seek it out merely to understand the velocity at which Ratzenberger's car hit the wall, it is not for the faint-hearted. The speed at which the car shoots off the track and into the wall is just terrifying. Roland wouldn't have had enough time to stop. In fact, I doubt he wouldn't even have enough time to apply the brakes properly. It all happened practically in the blink of an eye. The speed at which he crashed was so high, the car would continue moving all the way down to from the Villeneuve curve to Tozer, at several hundred metres. As the car spun, the extent of the damage was there for all to see. Whilst the survival tub was left relatively intact, most of the left-hand side of the car was gone. The bodywork and the barge boards had been ripped from the chassis, and the top of the engine cover was gone too. In fact, the engine was completely exposed and the rear of the car was gone as well. The front of the car was also gone. But worst of all, Roland Ratzenberger's head rolled around in the cockpit. He was knocked unconscious from the crash, and tragically he would never regain consciousness. Whilst he received treatment at the trackside and was airlifted to hospital, I personally reckon he was killed immediately, though I am not sure. Some reports suggested he died at the trackside, though others suggest he died as he was airlifted to hospital. Regardless, this shunt took Roland Ratzenberger's life. For the first time in 12 years, a driver had lost their life during a Grand Prix weekend. And it was the first time since 1986 where Elio De Angelis died during a testing accident at Paul Ricard in France that any Formula One driver had been killed in an F1 car at all. Formula One had seen a number of accidents which should have been fatal, even as recent as the day before, but on April 30th, 1994, the sport ran out of luck. The medical team arrived at the scene quickly and immediately set to work to try and save Roland Ratzenberger's life. For the second time in 2 days, they were tasked to do the most important of jobs. And whilst they were successful with Barrichello, there was no way to save Roland Ratzenberger. He'd suffered from a basilar skull fracture, and after being taken to the circuit's medical centre via ambulance, he was then loaded into a helicopter to be taken to hospital. But he was officially pronounced dead upon his arrival. Ed and Senna went to the scene of the accident, having seen the replays of the crash from his Williams garage, and after he found out that Roland had passed away, he cried. Famously, he and Professor Sid Watkins had a conversation where Watkins told his friend Senna that he should stop racing, that he was the fastest driver in the world with nothing more to prove, and that he should quit. Sid told Ayrton that he'd quit as well, and the two could just go fishing together. In reply, Senna told his friend that he couldn't quit, and he retreated back to his Williams team and didn't go back out on track again for the rest of the qualifying session. Senna had qualified on pole position anyway, with Michael Schumacher second, but no one really cared. People were in shock and coming to terms with the loss of Roland Ratzenberger. In a weekend which had seen a fatality and a near fatality in the space of 2 days, this was unprecedented for modern era Formula One. For many, this was their first experience of death in the sport. And the day after, the day of the San Marino Grand Prix, the reformation of the Grand Prix Drivers Association was agreed upon, with Ayrton Senna, Gerhard Berger and Michael Schumacher acting as directors. The GDPA have done great work since this to help make Formula One safer. And in many ways, Roland Ratzenberger's lasting memory is that across motorsport, the head and neck supporting device, also known as the hands device, is now basically mandatory. It's designed to prevent skull fractures such as the one that Roland suffered from, and it has been a great success. Whilst losing Roland was beyond tragic, at least he did not die in vain. Though in light of what was about to take place, his death is largely forgotten. He He's almost known as that other driver who died at Imola in 1994, and that wouldn't do him justice whatsoever. He was a talented driver who fought tooth and nail to achieve his dream of racing in Formula One, and he'd achieved it. You could say that he died doing what he loved, doing what he'd always dreamt of doing. But that is very much the faintest of silver linings. Max Mosley, the president of the FIA, was one of only a few major individuals from the world of Formula One who chose to attend Roland's funeral rather than Senna's. Max has since said that Roland had been forgotten about, and it was important that someone went to his funeral because everyone else had gone to Ayrton's. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Max Mosley, but I greatly respect him for this. And it sums up my personal thoughts as well. People need to remember that whilst the greatest driver in the world was about to leave us all, he wasn't the only driver who lost his life that weekend. Quite simply, never forget Roland Ratzenberger. Roland, may you rest in peace. There is perhaps no day in the history of motorsport that is as dark as May 1st, 1994. As the world tuned in for another Grand Prix, still reeling from the events of Saturday qualifying the day before, nobody knew that things were about to change forever. The Tifosi flocked in their tens of thousands to watch what there should have been a great race. The San Marino Grand Prix was always one of the better races on the calendar due to the challenging nature of the circuit. And with the Williamses and the Benettons being so closely matched, everything was set for a titanic battle. Ayrton Senna, despite struggling with his car, still managed to secure pole position for the race, with Michael Schumacher starting second alongside him. People expected Senna and Schumacher to have a proper battle like they did in Brazil, and there was a real sense of excitement, though naturally, this was tinged with apprehension. Imola had shown everyone that it was not a circuit to be messed with so far that weekend. In many ways, the drivers and the teams almost wanted the race over with. But the show has to go on, right? Roland would have wanted it to, I'm sure. The cars lined up on the grid, and the usual pre-race procedures were carried out, just like any other race. The drivers prepared themselves, one of which for the last time. Ayrton Senna sat in his car, seemingly praying. What about, we'll never know. But I would imagine he was asking God to protect him and to see him through the race, though this is just my own speculation and interpretation. In the build-up to the race that day, Senna had set the fastest lap in the morning warm-up session by nearly a second over everyone else. He'd also sat down with former rival Alain Prost for around 30 minutes, and the two had agreed to discuss safety in Formula One at the Monaco Grand Prix in 2 weeks. The two would never have that meeting. He also filmed a TV spot alongside Prost for the French TV channel TF1, and he told the cameras that he, along with everyone else, missed Alain. A very touching moment, considering they were bitter rivals. And Ayrton had helped reform the GDPA that morning as well. All of that, as well as dealing with the emotional impact of seeing a fellow driver die in a Formula One car the day before. And Ayrton had to do all this whilst being the leader for everyone else. He was the top driver in the sport and the best driver in the world. He took it upon himself to be there for everything. He was there for Rubens on the Friday, and he was there for Roland on the Saturday. Though apparently, he got in some bother for attending the crash site, and for commandeering a course car to take him there. Some things Ayrton was distraught about. It had been a frantic, emotional final 24 hours for the Brazilian. But come 2 p.m. local time, it was business as usual. He had to focus. He had a Grand Prix to win, and it was a Grand Prix he had to win. The helmet was on, the visor was down, and Ayrton Senna was about to compete in what would be his final race. As the light went to green to signal the start of the race, it was immediately clear that things were about to go badly wrong. JJ Leto, who had started fifth on the grid, had stalled his Benetton, and everyone dived to avoid his car. All Leto could do was hope that he would get away with this, but he didn't. Petro Lamy in the Lotus slammed into the back of the Benetton at a considerable speed, and debris went everywhere. In fact, a loose tyre flew over the fencing and into the crowd, injuring several spectators. It was a massive shunt, but amazingly both Leto and Lamy were able to walk away from their battered cars. You would have thought that a red flag would have been thrown to clear up such an incident, but no. The safety car came out. And when I say safety car, I mean a 1990s family saloon made its way onto the track to lead the field round. Compared to the Mercedes-Benzes that Formula One used today, it looks pathetic. In fact, at one point, Senna, who had maintained his lead after the race start, overtook the safety car and gestured frantically for it to speed up, as vital temperature was rapidly decreasing in the tyres as they followed it round. As the sixth lap began, the safety car peeled away, and the race restarted, with Senna leading Schumacher. What the world didn't know was that Ayrton Senna was about to complete his last lap. He rounded the final chicane and accelerated onto the pit straight to start the seventh lap. He entered Tamburello, and Ayrton Senna's Williams suddenly, violently, darted to the right near the exit of the corner and slammed into a trackside concrete wall at 190 miles per hour. The car would continue down the runoff area for several hundred metres or so, and would come to a stop with debris flying all over the track. Drivers were weaving all over the place to dodge the pieces of bodywork that had detached themselves. And it became very clear, very quickly, that Ayrton Senna was not in a good way at all. He was motionless in the car, his head laid over to one side, and as the race was red flagged, the world held its breath. Everyone had become so accustomed to drivers just climbing out of their cars after big shunts that I would imagine the fans at Imola and everyone watching on TV were waiting on Senna to come too, and to gingerly climb out of his car and head back to the paddock. But he didn't. The medical team arrived on the scene, and within just minutes of the crash, Ayrton had been extracted from his car and laid out on the ground. Professor Sid Watkins, for the third time in just 3 days, was now tasked to try and save a Formula One driver's life. He and the medical team got an airwave into Senna, and having raised his eyelids, Sid understood that the head injury that Ayrton had suffered was going to be fatal. Senna then sighed and his body relaxed, and Sid has gone on record to say that whilst he isn't a religious man, that he felt Senna's spirit depart at that moment. I can't even begin to imagine witnessing this. You would obviously stay professional and do your job, but to literally see your friend die in front of you, I couldn't even imagine it. And I hope that I never will. It was clear that the medical centre at Imola wasn't going to be a good enough facility to take Senna to, so a helicopter was called for. But there was almost another catastrophe whilst all this was taking place. Eric Comas in the LaRousse was allowed onto the track from the pit lane so he could rejoin the now red-flagged race. He approached the crash site at almost full speed before slowing right down as he was frantically weighed down by marshals that were trackside. John Watson, a commentator for Eurosport at the time, described that moment as being the most ridiculous thing he'd ever seen in his entire life. And Comas was so shocked by what he saw as he passed the scene of the crash and Senna's subsequent treatment that he withdrew himself from the race and he didn't speak of what he had witnessed for more than 10 years. In fact, what was happening was considered too much for the BBC here in the UK to broadcast, and they focused their own cameras on the pit lane. But Murray Walker, BBC's commentator, still had access to the main television feed, which was broadcasting footage of Senna being treated. And Murray had to balance telling the viewers at home that he was sure Senna was going to be okay, whilst knowing full well that the situation was the worst it could possibly be. After receiving treatment trackside for approximately a quarter of an hour, but what must have felt like several days, he was flown to hospital. As he flew away, the world could only watch on and hope and pray that he was going to make it. The general consensus on the grid amongst the drivers and the teams was that he was going to be okay. Whether that is something they genuinely believed or something they just told themselves, I'm not so sure. The race was restarted around 40 minutes later, and as the drivers left the grid for the second time, nobody knew the true extent of Ayrton Senna's condition. The San Marino Grand Prix was uneventful for the most part, apart from a botched pit stop, which saw two Ferrari mechanics and two Lotus mechanics suffer injuries from a loosely fitted tyre that had come off of Michele Alboreto's Minardi. The 1994 San Marino Grand Prix weekend had dealt its final blow with this. Michael Schumacher would dominate proceedings for the most part, despite being overtaken by Berger in the Ferrari after the second start. He would lead Nicola Larini in the other Ferrari home by over 50 seconds to win his third race in a row. Larini second, as I've mentioned. Hakkinen was third, and fourth, fifth and sixth would go to Carl Wendlinger, Yukio Katayama and Damon Hill respectively. Though this was as meaningless a race as anyone could imagine. During all this time, Ayrton Senna had arrived at hospital and frantic treatment began. After his heart stopped, he was placed on a life support machine. But at around 6:40 p.m. local time, a little over 4 hours after the crash, it was officially announced that Ayrton Senna was dead. Ayrton had sustained a number of injuries from his crash, which resulted in his death. Most notably, a tyre had come off the car thanks to the impact with the wall, and it came into the cockpit and forced Senna's head back into the headrest, which resulted in him suffering from a fractured skull. As well as the tyre hitting him, a piece of the suspension attached to the tyre penetrated his helmet, resulting in severe head trauma. And reportedly, a piece of the upright assembly had also penetrated his helmet, just above his right eye. Whilst it is certain that any one of these injuries would have killed him, all three of them combined left it in no doubt. But the amazing thing is, aside from the catastrophic injuries to his head and brain, he had no cuts. He had no bruising. If it wasn't the obvious, you could be mistaken for thinking that he hadn't suffered from a crash at all. His body was unharmed. And if Senna had crashed at a different angle, just slightly different from the angle that the car went into the wall, he would have survived. He would have walked away. But the angle he went into the wall at was such that everything that happened to him, happened. And the question of why the accident took place started to be asked, but it's still unanswered. people have their views. Some say the steering column broke, which would explain the sudden jolt that the car had, as it no longer steered left through Tamburello. I personally think that this is the reason. That it wasn't down to a slow puncture or a lack of tyre temperature or even driver error. Tamburello was not a corner you made a mistake on like that, especially drivers of the calibre of Ayrton Senna. Whilst blindingly fast, it was relatively simple. We can all discuss and debate the cause of the crash until we're blue in the face, but at the end of the day, we lost Ayrton Senna because of it. The greatest driver in the world was gone. The push for safety has never stopped since. With things 25 years on being as safe as it's ever been with the introduction of the Halo in 2018 and the head and neck device in the early 2000s, as I've previously mentioned. And despite the dangers of the sport and the number of gigantic accidents that we've seen, it took 20 years for a driver to die due to injury sustained during a Grand Prix, and that was Jules Bianchi. And I am sure someone else will die in a Formula One car in the future. That's not me being callous, that's me being realistic. No matter what is done to improve safety, Formula One and motorsport in general will never be safe. But the events of the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix weekend left the sport with a lot of self-evaluation to do. The sport needed to change and change quickly. Otherwise, there was a real chance that more drivers were going to die. And just 2 weeks after Imola, Carl Wengler crashed during Thursday morning practice at the Monaco Grand Prix. He hit his head on a section of the barrier lining the circuit, and despite receiving life-saving treatment at the trackside, Carl would remain in a coma for several weeks and his season was over. So soon after Imola, Formula One nearly lost its third driver. And if you count Barrichello, the sport could have lost four drivers in less than 2 weeks. Changes were made to several of the upcoming circuits to try and slow them down. A mobile chicane was created at one of the faster sections of the Circuit de Catalunya for the Spanish Grand Prix, and the same was done at the Canadian Grand Prix on the back straight, and at Spa for the Belgian Grand Prix, where instead of going through Eau Rouge and Radeon, the cars would navigate a chicane. And Silverstone took drastic measures to slow its layout down. They completely redesigned both Stowe and Abbey corners, with Stowe being made a slow-speed right-hander compared to the ultra-fast right curve it had been prior, and the flat-out left-hander at Abbey was replaced by a medium-speed chicane. And Imola lost two of its greatest corners, Tamburello and the Villeneuve curve. What were two flat-out corners are now replaced with chicanes. So Formula One was learning its lessons from Imola. This was something that Michael Schumacher said in the press conference immediately following the San Marino Grand Prix. He hoped that the sport learned from the events that took place. And the sport did. Senna's funeral was attended by approximately 3 million people as people lined the streets of Sao Paulo for the procession. 3 days of national mourning were called for in Brazil. And the Brazilian people were so devastated by Senna's death that one person even took their own life due to the grief. Senna was a hero to millions of Brazilian people, and that hero was now gone. Though the legacy he had left behind will never diminish. I mean, it's now 25 years on, and there's people like me creating podcasts about him and the events of Imola 1994. And that's because the importance of that weekend and of Senna's death is so important when discussing Formula One's history that you have to make these sorts of episodes. In fact, I would say that this is the most significant moment in the history of the sport. It's the day the sport changed. Ayrton Senna's death is still considered to be one of the most shocking moments ever captured on live television, and it's hard to argue that. I was 8 days away from my third birthday, so I obviously didn't watch the race live, but I've spent the last 2 decades plus watching, reading, studying the sport, and I still find this whole weekend difficult to comprehend and difficult to watch and see unfold. The Senna movie that came out in 2011 does a fantastic job of telling the story of that weekend, and I hope podcasts like this one, the one that you're listening to now, help tell the story, because it's something that every F1 fan should know about. Newer fans especially. I sense newer fans know about Imola 1994, but don't really know about it. And they should. You can't solely know about the positive things in F1. You have to understand and respect the sport at its worst. And Imola 1994 is absolutely the worst thing to ever happen to Formula One. And as time goes on, I can't see that ever changing. Nor do I want it to. To a huge number of fans, Ayrton Senna is considered to be the greatest driver in the history of motorsport. Not just Formula One, but the whole of motorsport in general. He was blindingly fast over one lap, and that was evident with him securing 65 pole positions, a record that he held for 12 years after his death, and was eventually beaten by Michael Schumacher, who secured his 66th pole position in 2006 at the San Marino Grand Prix. Whilst entirely coincidental, I find that incredibly spooky. Senna was able to push a car to its limits like no driver had been able to do before. He had a feeling for the car, which other drivers could only dream of. There's footage of him pushing his Lotus during qualifying at Adelaide in the 80s, which is just extraordinary to watch. The car is literally dancing around the corners, but if anything, Senna was able to use this how unstable the car was to make it go faster. Whilst most drivers would probably end up having a massive shunt in a situation like that, Senna was almost artistic with his driving. He was controversial. As I covered in episode 12, Senna vs. Prost, he did some questionable things, but no driver has been completely squeaky clean during their careers. When so much is on the line and when you're under so much pressure to succeed, cracks are bound to show, even in someone as good as Senna. He was incredibly charitable, and the Brazilian people adored him for that. He donated millions of dollars to help underprivileged children, and because of this, combined with his huge success and his infectious personality, made him a hero to the entire country, at a time where things weren't good in Brazil. And he provided something positive to people's lives. Senna was someone who provided the world with some incredible moments on track in his time, especially around Monaco. He was the master of Monaco, and still over a quarter of a century later, at the time of writing anyway, he still holds the record for the most amount of wins at F1's most famous race, with 6. Other races such as Portugal in 1985 and Donington in 1993 really do stand out as some of the greatest performances in the history of the sport. But Senna was genuinely brilliant every time he got into a Formula One car. Seeing him at work was an event in itself. It's something that I am very sad about, that I wasn't old enough to see him race live. In fact, I never saw him race live at all, whether on TV or in person. I wasn't even 3 years old when he died. And I didn't start watching F1 until I was 6. But I remembered watching things like the VHS video, Murray's Magic Moments, and Murray recapped Senna's career and showed off his greatest moments, and the way that he spoke about him was almost like he was this mythical figure, that he was beyond special, that he was the greatest. And I don't think my love for the sport would have grown at a young age if it wasn't for watching Ayrton Senna's highlight reel, so in many ways I am forever grateful to the man. And I'm just one example of this. There would have been millions of people discovering the sport who saw him drive and fell in love with it. Whilst he died in the most horrendous of circumstances, he and Roland didn't die in vain. Both their deaths sparked change, though it is beyond tragic that it took two fatalities in as many days to finally make the sport open its eyes to the reality that it was too dangerous. They now knew that even the best driver could die in a Formula One car. Quite simply, Ayrton Senna was the best. And arguably, he always will be. And I truly believe in another 25 years' time, 50 years after the events of the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix, we'll all still be here talking about Ayrton Senna in the same way. In my opinion, Ayrton Senna, the driver, and the man, both in life and in death, will always be immortal. Ayrton, may you rest in peace. This episode of F1 Everything was written and created by me, Rob. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast, and I hope that if you're new to the show, at least you stick around for future episodes. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and most other podcast apps, and leave a rating and a review, and share F1 Everything with your friends. F1 Everything is also on social media. Just search for F1 Everything on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I also host the Michael Schumacher podcast, again available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, most other podcast apps, and it's also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, so to be sure to like, share, subscribe, follow, you know the drill. Once again, thank you for listening. I'm Rob Manifold, and I'll see you around the next corner.